Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with revelations that the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates made a secret trip to the United States for meetings in Trump Tower during the transition with Stephen Bannon, Jared Kushner, and General Michael Flynn, and later in the Seychelles met with the founder of Blackwater, Eric Prince, who has a mercenary military force operating out of the UAE. Joining us to look into the role of the UAE in the 9/11 attacks is Christian Breitweiser, 9/11 widow activist and author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. We will discuss her article at the Huffington Post, UAE Financial and Transit Hub of 9/11 Terror, and the extent to which the Trump administration has made secret deals with the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who are behind the blockade of Qatar and are actively encouraging the U.S. to intervene in Iran. Then we look further into the growing evidence that the Trump administration is frantically trying to fabricate any excuse to demonstrate Iran's noncompliance with the terms of the P5+1 nuclear deal signed by Obama, which Trump has decried on the campaign trail and later as president as the worst deal in history. The author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, William Beeman, a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, who has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the UN, and the U.S. Congress, joins us to discuss his article at newamericanmedia.org, Trump Administration Signals Plan to Abandon Iran Deal. Then finally, with more demonstrations expected tonight on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, we will speak with the dean of the Berkeley Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky, the author of a new book, Free Speech on Campus. He joins us to discuss the potential of clashes between outside groups on the right, like the Proud Boys and the Fraternal Order of Alt Knights, and the RefuseFascism.org group on the left promoting demonstrations against a conservative speaker, Ben Shapiro. Later this month, Stephen Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos will cause more disruption and expense for the university in the hope they will be banned and thus become martyrs for free speech. And joining us now is Christian Breitweiser, 9/11 widow and activist, who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September 11 and in the months leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee with regard to national security reforms. She's the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow, and has an article at the Huffington Post, UAE Financial and Transit Hub of 9/11 Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christian Breitweiser.
Thanks for inviting me.
And there's a lot to cover here, but let's start with the latest news that the Crown Prince of the UAE was actually the person that was made a secret trip to the United States, to Trump Tower during the transition. Normally, the protocol is that foreign leaders and dignitaries inform the U.S. government that they're coming. This was a secret trip. And as you recall, Donald Trump made remarks which have been unsupported and have since the Justice Department have admitted that there's no basis to it, that he accused Obama of being a bad, sick guy for tapping Trump Tower, wiretapping Trump Tower. So they came up, the Trump people came up with this idea that there was an unmasking conspiracy going on involving Susan Rice and Devin Nunes, the flunky of the Trump administration, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, went over to the White House and eventually made such a fool of himself he had to recuse himself. So they were desperately trying to come up with something to get out from under Trump's terrible accusations of Obama. But now it turns out that Susan Rice, the National Security Council, did indeed unmask some Americans because the Crown Prince, MBZ as he's called, Mohammed bin Zayed of the UAE, had made this secret trip. And naturally, the U.S. government wanted to know who he was meeting with. And it turned out he was meeting with Jared Kushner, Stephen Bannon, and General Michael Flynn. So what do we know about these secret deals? That, as far as we know, we don't quite know what that deal in the White House in the Trump Tower was about. The Washington Post said the meeting later in the Seychelles was to set up a back channel with the Russians through the auspices of Betsy DeVos's brother, the mercenary army, Blackwater, figure, Eric Prince. What's your sense of the role of MBZ, who apparently is somebody that is quite a player, along with MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia? So the MBZs and the MBSs apparently are close to the Trump administration. What do you know about them?
You know, frankly, I don't. Some of what you just said is news to me. I don't. You know, I have a very limited understanding of MBZ and his role in MBS and how MBS took power back in June, much to the chagrin of MBN. I think what is refreshing to me, at a bare minimum, is that some of the focus of the Russian intervention in our politics seems to have now shifted over to the Gulf intervention in our politics, which I think is more appropriate, just particularly because of where I stand as someone fighting against a lot of these Gulf nations who are trying to get, in my opinion, a get-out-of-jail-free card for their role in funding and logistically supporting Sunni terrorism. So having said that, I don't know much about what those meetings could have been about. They might have been about JASTA, which is the legislation the 9/11 families fought for last year and indeed received an overwhelming amount of support from Congress to enable us to hold accountable any nation that funded the 9/11 attacks. Historically, victims of terror were only able to hold accountable official state sponsors of terrorism. And I don't know how much you know about getting on the list of the state sponsors of terrorism. It's very political. It's a very, in my opinion, bogus list, because it's all about, you know, who likes you and who doesn't. And frankly, some of the countries that deserve most to be on that list escape that list because they are very good at spending money in key places. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I certainly am refreshed that at least some sunlight is being shed on the fact that these Gulf nations certainly are very good at throwing their money around and buying their way around Washington from our leaders who are supposed to be representing our best interests.
And before we get to your article at the Huffington Post, UAE Financial and Transit Hub for 9/11 Terror, Kristen Breitweiser, there's another story, of course, which you're familiar with. It just came out that the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. may have funded a dry run of the 9/11 attacks. And this is evidence that's been submitted in the ongoing lawsuit against the Saudi government. This is a part of the JASTA complaint filed by, on behalf of 1,400 family members of the victims. And apparently the Saudi government paid two nationals posing as students in the U.S. to take a flight from Phoenix to Washington to test out flight security before the 9/11 attacks. And apparently the airfares were paid for by the Saudi embassy. And they apparently one of them worked for the Saudi embassy. The other one is an employee of the Saudi Ministry of Islamic Affairs. He reportedly aboard the airplane asked the staff where the bathroom was, and then pointed, when he was pointed in the right direction, instead he went into, tried to enter the cockpit, and the pilots were then made an emergency landing in Ohio, and the two men were released after an interrogation from the FBI. So, again, these things keep coming up, don't they? And
they do. I think, you know, there's just very clear patterns of activity of individuals with links to the Saudi government being paid by the Saudi government and behaving in ways that are very suspicious. And I think it's unfortunate that prior to the 9/11 attacks, a lot of these Saudi individuals were sort of released and leads were not followed up on simply because they were Saudi and they were given special privileges. Even in the wake of the attacks, these two guys who, you know, when you read the facts behind what went on here, look very, very suspicious. They fit the profile of all of the hijackers who, you know, did their practice runs across the United States. You know, the 9/11 Commission did interview them, and they interviewed them in Saudi, and they were free individuals. You know, they're not down in Guantanamo. They're walking free. And so I think that just speaks more to the fact that a lot of these Saudi people just sort of get off the hook because, you know, the Saudis are a no-go zone. You're not allowed to touch them. You're not allowed to ask questions because, like I said, they get special status. And I think that in many ways, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why the 9/11 attacks could have and should have been prevented. One of the many reasons is that the Saudis were given this kind of special treatment. And, you know, many people in our intelligence community were told to look the other way. And unfortunately, I think that continues even today.
Well, it does seem, though, that the UAE, and particularly the Crown Prince, MBZ, is a real player in the Trump administration. As you know, Kristen Breitweiser, Donald Trump, his most successful foreign trip, according to him, was Saudi Arabia, where he was able to do the sword dance and where they lavished him and his daughter, and MBS gave his daughter's foundation $100 million. There are rumors that the MBS is close now to Jared Kushner, has promised to help finance Trump's re-election. And it's pretty clear that the UAE and the Saudis are also working together to blockade Qatar, and they're also encouraging the U.S. to get into some kind of intervention with Iran, or at least break the nuclear deal, which we'll discuss in the next segment. So let's talk about some of the history here, which you've uncovered, and their role in 9/11, the UAE. It looks as though they were the conduit for almost all, in fact, 17 of the 19 hijackers transited through the United Arab Emirates in the months immediately preceding the 9/11 attacks. And it looks like their banking logistics were done. We don't know who organized this, because clearly this was an intelligence operation. This wasn't just a bunch of, I mean, most of these guys were uneducated Saudis from the country who only knew the Quran, and that they were somehow able to pull off this amazing deal, this amazing intelligence operation. So we still don't know who organized, who funded it. But from your reporting in the Huffington Post, it looks as though the UAE played a role as a conduit.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting is that most Americans, or, you know, the vast majority of Americans, know that, you know, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi, and certainly the 9/11 families have our lawsuit against the kingdom, and there is ample evidence found in the 28 pages, found by the Joint Inquiry of Congress, found by the 9/11 Commission. Clearly, the Saudis' hands are extremely dirty with regard to their role in the 9/11 attacks, both logistically and financially. But I think what's interesting is what happened, truthfully, is some information, some emails were leaked, and a lot of people learned that it wasn't just the Saudis who were fighting JASTA. It was also the UAE, specifically the ambassador to the UAE, this guy Otaiba. And so when I read those articles, I sort of was like, well, geez, why are they so worried about JASTA? Like, what, you know, it's not the ambassador of Japan in there in Congress lobbying against JASTA, lobbying against legislation that's going to hold funders of terror accountable. And so I started researching, and I think it's very interesting when you really look at the facts and the role that the UAE played in the 9/11 attacks. It's undeniable, and it's extremely damning. And I think what's so odd is that nobody seems to know about it. Nobody seems to care. And I think one of the main reasons for that is probably the simple fact that the UAE happens to be the number one lobbyist, you know, paid foreign nation lobbying in Washington. You know, they're ahead of Saudi with their amount of money that they throw around Washington, at least from the reports that I've seen. So all I can say is that perhaps that's why no one seems to know the role that the UAE played. But I think they tipped their own hand by lobbying so fiercely against JASTA and against the 9/11 families. And that set off our alarm bells. It got me researching personally. And I found all this information. And you're absolutely right. 17 of the 19 hijackers transited the UAE in the months before the 9/11 attacks. Now, why is that? Why did 17 out of 19 men transit through there? Why did all of the money, nearly all of the money that financed the attacks, flow through UAE banks and UAE wires? More to the point, bin Laden, when he was kicked out of the Sudan back in 96, needed to fly to Afghanistan. And you know what country allowed him to land his plane and refuel so he could make it to Afghanistan? The UAE. I mean, I really would like to know what would have happened if he wasn't allowed to land his plane. He most likely would have been arrested and brought to the United States back in 1996. Going further, there was a missile strike in 99 where they had Bin Laden in their sights. They were ready to take him out. The Clinton National Security Council is in the command. They have him in their sights. They're ready to take him out, and it gets called off. You know why it gets called off? It gets called off because he's surrounded by Emirati princes on his hunting trip in Afghanistan.
Right, and so they didn't, and they were about to sell a bunch of F-16s to the UAE, and that was the argument.
Know, exactly. So, you know, you start to see these things, and you're constantly seeing Dubai, the Emirates. And there is just a very clear trail linking them, you know, with some very suspicious connections to the 9/11 attacks. And I certainly hope people will read the blog and educate themselves and start to really understand that some of these Gulf nations are not our allies. They are people that participated, funded, logistically supported the terrorists that killed 3,000 people on our soil on September 11th, and that are still funding radical Sunni jihadists around the world that are carrying out attacks in Brussels, in Paris, in London, in San Bernardino, in Florida, you know, everywhere. And we need to demand that our leaders, like President Trump, like our members of Congress, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Bob Corker, stop pandering to these countries. Look at what's going on Wall Street. You've got the Saudi Aramco IPO. You've got everyone on Wall Street bending over backwards to cut this deal. You know, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia owns that company. So any shareholder who buys that stock is buying in to the crowdfunding campaign for jihad.
Sure. And then the second biggest funder and shareholder in Rupert Murdoch's holding company is the Saudi Kingdom Fund. So
the Sovereign Wealth Fund.
Sovereign Wealth Fund, yeah.
And that's what, you know, as Americans, if we really want to be safer, if we really want to know who our friends are, you have to take the time and do the research and learn. You can't just look at movies and think, oh, Dubai, that looks like a great place to go shopping or, you know, what have you. You need to educate yourself and learn where these terrorists that are bent on killing Americans are coming from, where they're being funded, and who's supporting them. Because our legislators, our leaders, our presidents have absolutely no trouble getting into bed with these people, selling weapons to these people. You know, what's going on in Yemen and Syria is appalling. The human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia are appalling, the way women are treated. Right. I don't understand it. I don't understand why Ivanka Trump would even take money from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The way they treat women,
I think I do.
It's just unacceptable.
I know it is, and it's heartbreaking, and it goes on. And I'm afraid we've run out of time, Kristen Breitwiser, but I really do appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Kristen Breitwiser, 9/11 widow and activist, who is known for pressuring Washington to provide a public accounting of what went wrong on the morning of September 11th and the month leading up to it. She testified before the Joint Inquiry of Congress in September and of 2002 and the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee with regard to national security reforms. And she's the author of Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, UAE Financial and Transit Hub of 9/11 Terror. Let's take a brief station break. We'll be back for looking into further evidence that the Trump administration is frantically trying to fabricate any excuse to demonstrate Iran's noncompliance with the P5+1 nuclear deal.
Politic needs votes. Politic needs your mind. Politic needs human beings. Politic needs lies. That's why.
Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war. Expected something better than before. did something more. Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Beeman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. He's best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, serving as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He's the author of 14 books, including The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And he has an article at newamericanmedia.org, Trump Administration Signals Plans to Abandon Iran Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Beeman.
Thank you very much.
And as far as I know, today there were some mixed signals, or it's hard to get a handle on this, and I'm kind of counting on you to explain a lot what's happening. Today in London, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the United States must consider the full threat it says Iran poses to the Middle East when formulating its new policies. And he added that Iran has breached the spirit of the 2015 nuclear deal. That's something that Trump himself has said. But today also, the Congress recertified that it's suspending sanctions. So
Ian, it was not the Congress that recertified it. It was the president.
Uh-huh.
It was the executive who recertified it. And that's a very important distinction because we're going to be coming up on October 15th with a possible congressional action or a direction to Congress to recertify these actions.
So, but the sanctions were imposed by the Congress, were they, or by the administration?
It is a very complicated matter. Sanctions can only be imposed by Congress, but under the terms of the JCPOA, the executive.
The JCPOA. The JCPOA is what's referred to as
the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action,
right,
and people oftentimes know this as the quote Iran deal unquote.
Right. Right. The P5+1. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And the executive is charged with continuing the suspension of sanctions that have been placed against Iran on a periodic basis. I think it's a 90-day basis. And in this case, the Trump administration, the executive branch, has agreed to continue the suspension of sanctions under that agreement.
Well, it is in the broader sense, though, it's pretty transparent, isn't it, that the Trump administration is looking for ways to get out of the so-called Iran deal.
Absolutely, they are. And Secretary Tillerson's statement that Iran has violated the spirit of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is, quite frankly, nonsense. Who knows what in the world he means when they talk about violating the spirit of the agreement? Nobody else would say that except the Trump administration. Certainly, the other five nations that were involved with the negotiations with Iran would not agree with this. Iran has been in total and complete compliance with every provision of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now, what the Trump administration is talking about are things other than Iran's nuclear activity that they don't like, and they've interpreted some of these things that they don't like as somehow unilaterally declaring them to be in violation of the quote spirit unquote of the agreement, and this is just fabrication. It's made up entirely out of whole cloth. And unfortunately, it's a bit of hype that I think the administration is putting out to the unsuspecting public in the United States, not well disposed to Iran anyway, to try to justify a reimposition of sanctions under very, very flimsy pretexts.
Well, the Secretary of State standing next to his British counterpart, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, in London, also said, "We have to consider the totality of Iran's activities and not let our view be defined solely by the nuclear agreement." So they want it both ways.
That may be true that right. You know, that the United States or Great Britain or anybody could outside of the agreement, completely separate from the agreement, react to things that Iran is doing that they don't like. But the agreement is the agreement. It's signed and sealed and has been agreed to by the P5 plus one nations in addition to Iran. So they may not like certain things that Iran does. They may not like the fact that Iran is involved with with supporting the Assad regime in Syria. They may not like the fact that Iran is testing conventional weapons such as ballistic missiles. But none of these things were contained within the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And so, again, if they want to impose sanctions on Iran for some other reason other than the agreement, well, they can try to get that done. And in fact, it may happen in the United States. But to try to claim that this is part of the agreement is absolutely false. It is a flat out misstatement. I could go so far as to say it is a lie. So they're trying very hard to squirm and wiggle and so forth to try to get a justification based on the JCPOA, but they really can't do it because it is quite clear that Iran has complied completely with the agreement.
And again, I'm speaking with William Beeman, a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. He's best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years and has served as consultants to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. And he's the author of 14 books, including The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And he has an article at newamericamedia.org, Trump Administration Signals Plans to Abandon Iran Deal. So what I was mentioning, William Beeman, was that essentially the Secretary of State's saying, we want it both ways. You know, we want to find an excuse to break the nuclear deal with the Iranians because we don't like the other stuff that they're doing, even if they are sticking to the nuclear deal. So that's a pretty bizarre thing, isn't it? The idea we want to break the nuclear deal even though they're not in violation of it, but we're going to find another way to break it by looking at other things that they're doing.
Well, let me give you my opinion of what they're really trying to do. They're trying to push Iran so hard that Iran will withdraw from the deal. So that the United States will not have the onus of having actually broken the deal. And so what during the waning days of the Obama administration, the Congress passed the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act of 2015. If people would like to, they can look it up. It's House Resolution 1191. It was passed virtually unanimously, and President Obama was more or less forced to sign it into law because there weren't enough votes to override a veto.
Was that the one that was 98-1 in the Senate that was Bob Corker and Senator Cardin co-sponsored?
No, that is another one.
Okay.
And just recently, the Corker-Cardin bill passed 98-1, mm-hmm. which imposed additional sanctions on certain parties in Iran. It was a largely symbolic bill. It singled out some individuals who were part of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, who were said to have been supporting terrorist actions. And it singled out a couple of institutions that were providing money transfer to groups that the Corker and Cardin and their supporters said were supporting terrorist action. So there really have been two bills one, the Nuclear Agreement Review Act, has the potential for reimposing the sanctions that were suspended as a part of the JCPOA. The Corker-Cardin bill actually did impose some additional sanctions They were very minor. It made Iran extremely unhappy, but it did not cause Iran to actually say that it was a violation of the JCPOA, and so therefore Iran was withdrawing. However, on October 15th, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, the 2015 Act, will come up for review, and the president is required to report to Congress on October 15th whether Iran is in compliance. And it's not that they're in compliance with the JCPOA, it's whether they're in compliance with the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. And that act contains all sorts of extraneous things that have nothing to do with Iran's nuclear activity. It has to do with human rights. It has to do with support for terrorist organizations as determined by the Secretary of State. It has to do with testing of ballistic missiles and a whole litany of other things. And so my guess is that because the Trump administration is so desperate to try to get rid of the JCPOA, that he will report to Congress that Iran is not in compliance with the Review Act of 2015. Of course, Iran never agreed to this act. This is entirely unilateral on the part of the United States. And then Congress has 60 days to decide whether they're going to reimpose sanctions. But what is good for the, I guess, for the Trump administration is that once he reports to Congress that they are not in compliance, it's out of his hands completely. It's not something that he can that he says that was done by him or his administration. It will be entirely in the hands of Congress, and given the Corker-Cardin vote, the 98-1 vote for imposing these minor sanctions, it seems to me that there may be and of course the overwhelmingly positive vote for the original 2015 act. It seems to me that the chance of there being of the reimposition of sanctions being passed by Congress is very great. Now, I think that their hope is at that point that Iran will be so upset and so angry that they will withdraw themselves from the JCPOA, and then the Trump administration's problem will be solved, and it will not be the fault of the United States. That's what they'll claim.
Right, but if Trump can blame the Congress, it's not going to do any good. It's not going to allay the anxiety and anger of the Europeans and the other signatories. You know, it's China, Russia, Germany, the UK, and France.
Well, you can bet that China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK are not going to withdraw from the agreement. Mm-hmm. The United States would they're not going to withdraw from the agreement under any circumstances. And the United States has already claimed that no matter what sanctions it imposes on Iran, the United States is not formally withdrawing from the agreement. So it's a situation where the Trump administration wants to have its cake and eat it too. They don't want to be accused of destroying the agreement, but at the same time, they still want to impose these sanctions. Their hope is, I think, that Iran will withdraw. And if Iran withdraws, then the whole thing falls apart, because Iran can do that unilaterally, because it's an agreement between the P5 plus one and Iran. So I actually think that the Iranians are, you know, they're quite aware of this. The foreign minister, Javad Zarif, has a PhD from the University of Denver, the distinguished University of Denver School of Foreign Policy, and also from his undergraduate degrees from UCLA. This is a very, very savvy individual, and he knows precisely what the game is. So I think that Iran will find a way to insist that the JCPOA is still active, but probably will accuse the United States of acting in bad faith and actually violating the terms of the agreement, and will probably put pressure on the other signatories to put pressure on the United States to modify their stance.
Right, but the one thing that seems so counterintuitive about this whole effort to get out of this deal, you know, and of course Donald Trump made all kinds of reckless announcements on his campaign trail, like building a wall, which he insists on fulfilling these promises, no matter how crazy they are.
Actually, you know that today he said he wasn't going to build a wall, so you know, so one never knows what Donald Trump.
Well,
is,
no, he said. I thought he said that he reversed what he apparently said over dinner with Chuck and Nancy at the White House, that he wouldn't build the wall, or at least not this time around, and now on. Down in Florida on the plane, he said he was going to build the wall. And that,
so who knows?
And that nothing would happen without the wall. In fact, I'm quoting him directly. So it's hard to follow him, I understand. But the point being that he said on the campaign trail that this was the worst deal in history, this Iran deal. And it's
right.
mostly to do with the fact that Obama made the deal, because he has this obsession with undoing everything that Obama did. This is a man driven by an irrational hatred of America's first black president, who he demonized and said wasn't even an American citizen for the longest time. So that's what's going on in the mind of Donald Trump, so to speak. But why aren't the adults pointing out the obvious that the Rouhani and Zarif, the guy that you just mentioned, the foreign minister, are in a very delicate situation. The hardliners, including the supreme leader, who has absolute authority and controls the Pasdaran and the Quds and the IRGC and has the levers of power, they were very skeptical of the deal, and they'll be absolutely thrilled if the Americans blow the deal up. And then Rouhani will be finished. So the idea of moderation in Iran will go out the window.
Well, our latest information, obviously it's gossip, but our latest information is that Khamenei is quite aligned with Rouhani in maintaining the deal. And that this has kept a lot of the hardliners at bay. Who have been, you know, skeptical and have been trying to, they themselves have been trying to get Iran to withdraw from the agreement. But what the Trump administration may be counting on is that if there's enough hostile action from the U.S. Congress or from Trump himself, that Rouhani and Zarif and even Khamenei will lose credibility in Iran. And that there'll be pressure on Iran to withdraw because of these the hostile actions on the part of the U.S. And the U.S. government would like nothing more than for the Iranians themselves to withdraw. Because then the United States could say we're blameless. We haven't done anything wrong. And if we imposed other sanctions, it wasn't because of the Iranian violations of the nuclear agreement. It was because of other things they did that we don't like. Never mind the fact that everything that they object to with regard to Iran is legal, has not been sanctioned by anybody else, and it's just things that we don't like. We have very little justification for imposing them, but that doesn't mean that we can't do it. You can impose sanctions on anybody if you can get the support of Congress or support of the legislature. So, as I say, I think that the aim here is to antagonize Iran to antagonize it to the point where the Iranians actually withdraw themselves. This would be very, very, very damaging to Iran. But I will also say this, and that is that if the deal blows up for some reason or another, Iran, in the time that the agreement has been in force, has cemented tremendously productive economic relations with other countries in Asia. They are doing land office business with Central Asia, with India, and with China. And these economic relations are not going to go away. So if the United States was trying to, I don't know, cripple Iran or reduce its influence, they have failed already. And nothing that we can do, nothing that the United States can do, is really going to turn back the clock on this particular situation.
Well, but there are Middle East players that are driving the U.S. hostility or the Trump administration's hostility to Iran, principally Israel. The APAC were behind the Corker-Cardin bill that passed 98
to
That's there's no secret about that. We know that there's a de facto
AIPAC is doing that. But have you read the news on Israel lately?
What's that?
The Israel is mired in scandal.
Oh, of course, Netanyahu's family.
Who knows how long Netanyahu is going to be in office? And Netanyahu was the chief driver of Israeli hostility toward Iran. Even Mossad, the former leaders of Mossad have said repeatedly that Iran is not an existential threat to Israel. It's only been Netanyahu and on occasion Ehud Barak.
Right, but Netanyahu's not alone though. You've got the Israeli right, which is powerful. You've got the Egyptian leader Sisi, who's in league with the Saudis, who fund him and keep him afloat. The Saudis and the Emiratis are pushing hard on the U.S. to find some justification, even to go to war against Iran. So you have this alliance, de facto alliance, between Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE against Iran.
I wish that the Trump administration and in fact, the U.S. government was a little more sophisticated, because what we have here are the Saudis and Israel who essentially want the United States to do their business.
Dirty work.
They see Iran as a threat, and they want the United States to come in and take out Iran in one way or another. And they're not willing to do it themselves. They're coming to Washington and trying to insist that the United States do the dirty work.
Right.
And the dirty work might consist of an armed conflict. Iran will not launch a first strike, as much as the United States would love to provoke it into doing so.
Right.
Well, Iran has a 300-year history of not attacking anybody.
Well, we're running out of time, but I know there's the wild card of Eric Prince and his mercenary army there in the UAE.
Eric Prince. Yes.
Yeah,
indeed.
But let's finish up on the stupidity of doing this, because this is the opposite way to free Iran from the mullahs, and you go there a lot. My understanding is that there are two Irans. There are the young Iranians who want to be part of the world, don't like the isolation, can't stand these thieving mullahs. And then you've got these hardliners who are death to America types, who are preaching to a diminishing choir, even though they've stolen most of the nation's treasure. So is there a way that we can give aid and comfort to the young Iranians? Because everything that Trump's doing is doing the opposite.
Yes, it is a serious problem, because the U.S. government, or at least the Republican Party, and the neoconservatives have viewed Iran as a monolith for the longest time. And despite all the efforts of people like me, who are Iran experts, to try to emphasize the point that you've just made, that Iran has more than two-thirds of the population is under 40. They don't even know about the revolution. They never knew Ayatollah Khomeini. They want to be part of the world. They are extremely positively disposed toward the United States. But without any diplomatic representation and with continual hostility toward Iran, there's no way to reach these people in a reasonable way. The fact that they remain so positively disposed to the U.S. is really a kind of a miracle. But they do.
Right.
And they are a great asset. They would be a great asset for us and for the world if they could be more effectively reached. By the way, our allies in Europe all have embassies in Iran, including the British. Right. And the British embassy reopened, and we have a Canadian embassy there. There are all these diplomatic channels that are coming from other countries to Iran. The United States is the only major nation that doesn't have diplomatic representation there. And we have diplomatic representation with all kinds of countries that we disagree with, but for some reason we don't want to talk to Iran. And that's a terrible mistake.
Well, William Beeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with William Beeman, a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress, and the author of 14 books, including The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And he has an article at newamericamedia.org, Trump Administration Signals Plans to Abandon the Iran Deal. We can take a brief station break and back looking into how more demonstrations are expected tonight on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the Berkeley Law School. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, The Case Against the Supreme Court, and his latest book, co-authored with the Chancellor of University of California, Irvine, Howard Gilman, is Free Speech on Campus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And, Erwin, there's obviously a clash now on campuses between free speech and hate speech, both of which are protected by the Constitution, of course. And at Berkeley, there's going to be a demonstration tonight, a Thursday, to demonstrate against, well, a group called RefuseFascism.org is organizing against a speech by Ben Shapiro, the founder and editor of a conservative website, The Daily Wire. And later in the month, Stephen Bannon will be speaking at Berkeley along with Milo Yiannopoulos. They will be there later in the month for Free Speech Week, which is a four-day event organized by the Berkeley Patriot, which is a right-wing student publication. So my sense is that given what happened in Charlottesville, where in many ways you make the argument that was a manifestation of domestic terrorism, certainly in the case of the young woman being mowed down by a car, but is there a connection here between the notion that terrorists crave attention and fringe political radicals crave attention? And is it possible to ignore these people?
Of course we can't ignore them. But what's important is, on campuses, all ideas and views can be expressed, no matter how offensive. Ben Shapiro has a right to come onto the campus and be invited by a student group. Milo Yiannopoulos has a right to come on the campus and be invited by a student group. So would the most progressive speakers have the right to come on campus. And then the campus needs to take the steps, as it's doing, to protect their ability to be there, and most of all, to safeguard public safety.
Well, what's ironic about Ben Shapiro is that he resigned from Bannon's Breitbart News after a colleague of his accused Corey Lewandowski, then Trump's campaign manager, of assaulting her. And Breitbart hung her out to dry. Shapiro was a mensch, supported her, and made a statement at the time, Stephen Bannon is a bully. He has sold out Andrew Breitbart's mission in order to back another bully, Donald Trump. He has shaped the company into Trump's personal Pravda. So I find it a little odd that you got Bannon himself coming to Berkeley, and yet RefuseFascism.org and other leftist groups are protesting Ben Shapiro. He doesn't sound like he's anything in the same league as Stephen Bannon if you're on the left.
Well, I agree with you. I also very much disagree with so much of what Ben Shapiro says, but he has the right to say it. Steve Bannon has the right to say it. What's of great concern, though, is that groups off campus want to come and try to silence the speaker. The campus is spending an enormous amount of money on security today. They're closing part of the avenue in front of the campus. They're closing several classroom buildings. They're putting up cement barricades so as to preserve the right of Ben Shapiro to speak. The campus is doing the right thing, but at huge cost.
And these outside groups, the alt-right, or actually some of the new groups are called the Proud Boys on the right and the Fraternal Order of Alt-Knights. And I mentioned the group on the left, the organizers of protests against Ben Shapiro, refusefascism.org. And then, of course, there's the Black Bloc group and the Antifa group. The one thing about the Antifa, though, Erwin, was when I interviewed some of the clergy who demonstrated in Charlottesville, led by Dr. Cornel West, they told me that they literally were protected and defended by the Antifa people. Otherwise, they would have been beaten up by the Nazis. They were standing there in peaceful protest holding hands, and they were converged on by these heavily armed Nazis with helmets, body armor, clubs, and guns. So obviously, the issue here should be you can have a demonstration, but you shouldn't show up with helmets, body armor, clubs, and guns. Isn't that something for the police
absolutely
to deal with?
Right. That's absolutely right. No one goes to a demonstration with guns or clubs to engage in civil discourse. Campuses can and should prohibit people from carrying weapons into places where there's speakers. I know that tonight at Zellerbach Auditorium on the Berkeley campus, there will be weapons detectors, and no one is going to be allowed in the hall if they're carrying weapons. That's the way that it should be. There's never been a court that said there's a Second Amendment right to bring guns to a demonstration.
So is the issue then just police resources? Because campus police forces tend to be small.
Well, the difficulty is that campuses have to both protect public safety and also safeguard the right to speak. And often, in order to do both, is enormously expensive. I think the estimate that I've heard is that Berkeley is going to spend about $800,000 tonight to preserve Ben Shapiro's ability to speak. There's about 600 police officers who are there to do this. This is money that's not going then to scholarships for students or educational programs or research at the university. I think it's going to cost millions of dollars for the campus to have Free Speech Week week after next for Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter and Steve Bannon to come speak. This is very troubling, but I think that the campus has to protect freedom of speech.
And again, I'm speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the Berkeley Law School. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, The Case Against the Supreme Court, and his latest book, co-authored with the Chancellor of UC Irvine, Howard Gilman, is Free Speech on Campus. So is there a way that you can make the case then that if you want to come and you're looking for attention, and that is clearly the case with Breitbart and these other publications, they tend to be provocative rather than informative. They are bomb throwers. They want attention. Is there a way to find alternative venues for these people that's not on campus? What is it about the campuses? Do they literally want to be on campus, right? They want this kind
of... I think what they most want, ironically, is to be kept from speaking. I think with people like Milo Yiannopoulos, Ann Coulter, and Steve Bannon, who we're happiest with, is not being able to speak, because then they can be martyrs and victims whose free speech rights are denied. Campuses are allowed to have what's called time, place, and manner restrictions. There's a right to speak, but it doesn't mean at any place, at any time, any manner. And so Ben Shapiro, as we said, is speaking on the UC Berkeley campus tonight, but they're having him speak in an auditorium, the largest on campus. They're restricting access. You have to have a ticket, ID, so they can control the perimeter and protect safety. Now, if the campus were to say to him, you have to speak miles away, then that wouldn't be a reasonable time, place, or manner restriction.
Well, is there a difference or distinction between right-wing and left-wing groups on campus in terms of funding, attention, etc.? Because I know this fellow, David Horowitz, who used to be a lefty. He used to be the editor of Ramparts during the Vietnam War. And then he discovered that if you're a prodigal son from the left, right-wing donors will throw money at you. And he's created a campus organization, which has been very effective, at least well-funded. I don't know how effective it's been. So what is the alignment of forces, if you will, on campus? Are there basically a group of apolitical students in the middle, well-funded activists on the right, and I'm not sure about on the left? How do you see this was an order of battle in a military sense?
It's so much more complicated than that. Let's start with the speakers who we're talking about, Ben Shapiro, Miley Yiannopoulos, Ann Coulter, Stephen Bannon. They're all off-campus speakers. The intense reaction against them, like Antifa, are off-campus. On-campus, you certainly have a large number of students and faculty who just want to go about their educational and research mission. You have conservative students, especially on a campus like Berkeley, who are pushing to have conservative speakers there. You have a lot of liberal students on campus who are saying, this is hate speech. We shouldn't tolerate this on our campus. Don't let them come. And then, of course, you've got those who are pro-speech on both the left and the right. So it's a complicated dynamic, but it's a very strange dynamic, different from what we've seen before, say, during the anti-war protests on campuses.
Well, just in closing then, tell us about your book, Free Speech on Campus, which you've co-written with the Chancellor of the University of California, Irvine, Howard Gilman. Obviously, he's somebody with direct responsibility in terms of being a chancellor, and you're the dean of the Berkeley Law School, so you're there at ground zero at Berkeley. What are you hoping to achieve with this book, Free Speech on Campus?
To educate people about free speech, to also say that campuses must be places where all ideas and views can be expressed. But campuses also have to find ways of making sure that all students feel welcome and even protected. But it can't come by suppressing speech. So our thesis is, as I said, all ideas and views can be expressed, no matter how offensive, but campuses can also take steps on their own so as to affirm the kind of community they want to be and to condemn hate speech.
Well, are you going to get bankrupted there at Berkeley, though, by if they keep showing up, these out-of-town unwanted guests that are ostensibly brought in by a rather small group of right-wing students? That seems to be the pattern here. At what point do you say, you know, enough already?
The law doesn't provide a clear answer to that. I think the best you can get from the law is that the campuses take reasonable steps to protect public safety before canceling a speech. And if it cancels a speech on public safety grounds, it has to be for that reason and not because of the viewpoint expressed. But where do you draw the line? How much does the campus need to spend? There's no clear answer to that. I think that the chancellor at UC Berkeley, Carol Crisp, has made the right choice in saying, this is a campus that supports free speech, and we're going to spend the money to make sure it happens. But where is the line drawn? When does it become too much? I don't have an answer to that.
Well, Erwin Chemerinsky, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we've been speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the Berkeley Law School. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. And his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, The Case Against the Supreme Court. And his latest book, co-authored with the Chancellor of UC Irvine, Howard Gilman, is Free Speech on Campus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.